Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, while Egyptians regard the trial of former President Hosni Mubarak with mixed feelings, some Christians are hoping it's the first step towards democracy. As the biggest ever series of cyber hacking has world governments and businesses scrambling to recover, we talked to one of the European Union's cybersecurity experts. And remembering 9/11 as one human family, we talk with a member of the Catholic lay community St. Egidio about their plans to mark the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks on the U.S. The trial of former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and his two sons began this week in Cairo. Egypt's former interior minister and six police commanders are also on trial. Mubarak, who ruled the country for some 30 years, faces charges ranging from corruption to ordering the killing of protesters during the spring uprising that toppled his presidency. The trial is due to resume August 15th, but some are already criticizing the proceedings as window dressing, distracting the country from pressing problems. 6 months after Mubarak fell, Egypt remains in turmoil. Protesters are still on the streets demanding that the military rulers enact swifter reforms and trials for former regime stalwarts. Lydia O'Kane spoke to Michael Mounier, president of the U.S. COPS Association, about the effect these latest events are having on Christians living in Egypt.
Seeing this image of him being tried, I think it's a day of retribution to a lot of families, a lot of Christian families who spent the last 30 years dealing with churches being burned and bombed and looted and destroyed with no actions from his government, in addition to obviously the family of the victims from all kind of acts perpetrated during his presidency, lasting with the killing of revolution martyrs. So I think the image is historic because it tells every future leader of Egypt that no one is immune from prosecution, as most have thought after the 52 revolution. And there will be a day of reckoning for people that misuse their power.
The protests brought out all communities on all sides out onto the streets. Do you think that's also been a unifying force, as it were?
Well, I mean, for the most part, some thugs that try to attack some lawyers, etc. And it's expected to have people who made billions from the Mubarak regime. They still have their money. A lot of them are outside of Egypt. A lot of them are still untouched in corruption scandal or whatnot. And a lot of them are trying to create some unrest. So there will be some people who have some interest to destabilize the country, let alone the acts coming out from Saudi and other governments in injecting tons of money to the Salafis and the Brotherhood and the fanatics, elements of the Egyptian society. All these factors are in play to try to destabilize the country. But I think for most part, the trial itself is the first sign of the revolution succeeding.
You talked there a little bit earlier about Christian families who obviously had been affected. With regard to that, again, coming back to the idea of trials of the people involved, do you think that does bring about a sense of, for them, a sense of reconciliation, a sense of something being done?
Not entirely, to be honest with you, because none of the crimes he's been tried for so far, or the interior minister who spent about 12 years in the ministry, had to do with a direct attack on Christians or their families or properties. Even though we know that up until last January 1st, there was an attack in Alexandria and a church bomb that claimed lots of lives, over 120 lives and wounds. So not having a direct crime related to Christians and what they have suffered under his regime, it does not give us this great joy of retribution, but for all Egyptians, I think it does.
I mean, we're still seeing protesters on the streets. They're demanding that the military rulers enact swifter reforms and trials of the former regime stalwarts, as it were. I mean, is that coming from all sections of society, all communities that are out on the street?
I think most non-religious parties, most secular forces in Egypt still wants to curb the military council power, still wants to move on with concrete steps to take the country into civilian leadership. And most people are still worried that at the end, the trial might end up being some sort of a TV show to get people thinking there was justice and then it might fold into nothing. So what's happening is liberal forces are trying to keep pressure on the military council, saying you need to bring him to trial. Now you brought him to trial. You need to finish this trial quickly, because in Egypt and through the judicial system, things can take years to materialize. The council has realized that the forces on the streets are greater to ignore and people in Tahrir are greater to ignore, and they have decided to move forward.
What is it like at the moment for Christians, their everyday life, with regard to relations with Muslims? What is the general situation? Are there still tensions? Have things improved?
Actually, things haven't improved. This is the unfortunate part in this whole thing, that we saw the revolution got out members of the Jamaa Islamiyah, who had in the past deemed killers, who had killed people in the government and killed people on the streets and killed Christians, and were in jail. They got out. They started actually forming political parties. They have every freedom to move around, and Christians are still asking the military council to allow them to build their churches. Christians are still asking for a law against discrimination. So we feel that in all what we've given to the revolution, we have not received anything tangible in return. On the contrary, the security situation is poor in Egypt. We've had many incidents where churches have been attacked after the revolution with no arrest or trial of anybody except one case. And we've had cases of white and systematic attacks on Christians in many villages with low response from the military council, because the council doesn't want to get into a situation where they have to use force against people. So the situation for Christians right now, it's not really great.
Michael Monier is the president of the U.S. Copts Association. Someone in my house inadvertently downloaded a virus recently on our home computer. It could even have been me. I do pretty well on computers and think I'm careful about opening emails and unknown applications on the internet. But like most people, I don't know much about how to deal with a virus if I actually get one. So that's why I was keen to speak to an expert on European cybersecurity when she came through Rome not long ago. Alessandra Falcinelli is a legal expert on network and information security with the European Commission in Brussels. She says her office is working on protocols to help raise awareness about how individual users can protect themselves on the internet. And given the rising number of mega cyber attacks on governments and businesses around the world, it's also working out ways to ensure security for EU member nations. That's no easy feat in a world where everything from telecommunications, transportation, electricity and gas grids, to banks and businesses are all increasingly interconnected.
You got the right point, interconnectedness. Everything is interconnected. So I cannot think, for example, we had the shutdown of the internet in Egypt a couple of months ago. This didn't have any impact on our life, on our internet life, but still it could have, because we are all interconnected. We cannot think that something happening on the other side of the world has no impact on us. So let's say that first we focus on prevention. So that's the most important thing. That's why we talk about cybersecurity. Or rather, in Europe, and that's also the name of the unit I work in, network and information security. So we focus on preparedness. And preparedness, prevention, and response, let's say. So this has to be done first at national level. So that's why we are calling upon all the member states to, for example, put in place or adopt national cybersecurity strategies, but also to have CERTs in place. CERTs are computer emergency response teams, which, let's say, gets signalations or from single users, for example, in case of a vulnerability, and then handle
an alert, you mean?
Exactly, yeah, and then handle the security incident, all the vulnerability. And not all the European member states have in place a CERT. Then we can go at the European level. So, for example, these CERTs, once we'll have one per each member state, we can create a network of CERTs, so we will have no weak link. Or, for example, cyber preparedness exercises. So we make tests. So we create a scenario of an attack and we see how we could respond to this attack, how communication channels could be used in case of an attack. And this is something also that all member states should do at the national level. And this, I'm very proud to say, we already had one exercise at pan-European level in November, for example, which went very good. And we had, of course, some lesson learned. And we are going to have another one, a second one in 2012, probably.
We talk about interconnectedness, but a lot of companies have insular individual networks. For example, I'm thinking of Vatican Radio. We have our intranet, and we are also on the internet. We're connected, sure, to Facebook and to Twitter and YouTube and all that. How can individual businesses, I suppose, respond to infiltration by a hacker? I'm thinking of banks, I'm thinking of communications, radio, television. How can individual corporations react to a threat like that?
Well, of course, that's why, first of all, one of the main points, all of these that I talk about, certs and the, cyber exercises, etc., are, yes, from the member states, or it's public authorities taking action. But one of the main points is the partnership with the public, with the private sector. So once they're going to really make a partnership and work together, they're probably going to find what are the baseline action to take. And we call it risk management, for example. What are the risk? What is the risk management methods that we should use, for example? And what we created very recently in 2009, also it's a work of my own unit, it's the European Public-Private Partnership for Resilience, also called EP3R, which is a very interesting name. And it's a platform for discussion. They meet, three or four times per year. And you have members of national authorities, so you have representatives from governments and representatives from companies, telecom companies, ISPs, etc. And they both discuss how actually they could improve their own security and their risk management. So somehow, first to partner together, so really I can benefit from your own work and efforts, and also how actually we think we should do to improve. So for I realize that what I do is not enough or is not appropriate, and I learned the lesson from somebody else. Mm-hmm. So that could be important. And then also very important is the standards. So of course Europe is working on setting what the appropriate standards could be. So the standards then once developed or once we decide to use the ones that are in place, also probably especially private sector can benefit from them and exploit them. Mm-hmm.
What happens if a private citizen finds him or herself the object of a hacker, identity theft? Where should they be going to seek help?
And that's a very interesting question. For example, I'll make you the example of botnets, because now when we have this kind of disruptions in our own in our own computers, for example, very often it's a botnet. So it's a net, let's say a network of little vulnerabilities that are spreading across all our individual private computers. We have some member states in Europe which have really adopted important strategies for that. For example, the Netherlands, for example, Sweden or Germany. So in Germany now, they set up a number that you can call and they tell you how to clear your computer from the botnet.
I can't understand this word you're using. Botnet.
Botnet. Yes, botnet. Now I hope I'm going to give you the right definition. But let's say when you have a virus in your computer, it's a kind of vulnerability.
Right.
So in the botnet, you have a network of vulnerabilities. And I have it and I can pass it to you because we are in the same network. So it's even the user is somehow responsible for the spread of a botnet, of course, unconsciously. And without having awareness of that. And this is of extreme concern right now. We had the Mariposa botnet, the Mariposa network, which was huge, including thousands of computers. So that's why it's very important that we have these national strategies in place. And we want everybody to learn from these national strategies. That's why, for example, I referred to you about our cooperation with the United States. We are deciding to work let's say, put together experts from the EU and the US to talk together and learn lessons about how fighting botnets, which is very important because really it's about our, it's about us as individual users.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny we're talking about this because this morning I was having serious problems with my computer at home. I installed a few weeks ago. One of the technicians suggested I get a free antiviral and an anti-malware software from the web, and he told me which ones. So I installed these on my computer. They worked fine, but now I keep getting requests, you know, saying that I need to acquire, I need to buy some more of this product in order to be completely safe. Mm-hmm. And then this morning, I can hardly use my computer. I don't know if it has anything to do with these antivirals or what. So how, first of all, I've got to try to clean my computer again. What is the answer?
Well, first of all, like very practical, in very practical terms, I referred to you about the German initiative. This German initiative against botnets is, of course, involving also these antivirus companies. So that's interesting because it's about cooperating together with these companies. So we really know that they also want to help the users. We are sure about that. And second point, I also had problems a couple of years ago. Now I'm not very proud of it because I work in this area, although as a lawyer. But anyway, I had some problems with virus. I was not protecting my computer appropriately. So this is a point of awareness raising. That's the problem. And that's also what we are working on. I have to say that especially in Europe, we have one of the European community agencies, which is ENISA, so the European Network and Information Security Agency, which is located in Heraklion, Greece, so very nice place. And they work a lot about getting together public and private sector. They are talking about that they work a lot about stimulating discussions, etc. And also they do a lot about awareness raising. So that's very important. They regularly publish reports which are tailored for the user. And last year, for example, one about social networking, which was giving a number of golden rules to follow for the user, extremely simple ones that everybody can really understand. So awareness raising is very important. Of course, we have not to repeat ourselves because, of course, we have leaflets saying, okay, protect your computer, do this, do that. We should be innovative in this respect and try to get a smart way to do awareness raising.
I have my computer at work. We have technicians, so if I have a problem, the technician will resolve the problem. But I get home at night, and if I have a problem, who do I turn to? I mean, is there any sort of resource out there that could help me as a private citizen, you know, pick up a phone, a hotline, saying, you know, what do I do? I'm in, I've got an emergency.
Well, depend. For example, what kind of emergency hotline? You say we have in place in Europe hotlines in the case a user detects child pornography images, for example, which is not a problem for your own computer, but it's a problem for us as a users, for the society as a whole. So we have hotlines in place also in member states. So as you refer to hotlines, but in general, our let's say that our point would be to empower the user himself or herself. So we talk about e-skills. Also in this, the digital agenda is extremely committed because, of course, we have 30% of European citizens who never use the internet, for example. And we want to take this number lower, take it to 15% by 2015. But to do this, we need to have IT classes in school, for example, more than we have now. And we have to be aware also that in future time, let's say in a couple of years, 90% of jobs will require some kind of IT skills. So the IT skills we now may only need at home, we will need them at work. And indeed, I'm also every day challenged by what I actually have to learn, because otherwise I'm not going to get through with my job, and even if it's only an Excel spreadsheet.
So what is the EU doing to empower citizens to protect themselves better while surfing cyberspace? Its old data protection framework from 1995 is being updated, Falcinelli says. While focus then was more on protecting people from unwanted advertising and spam, now some of the most common security threats are coming from social media on the net.
Of course, data protection 15 years ago was rather about, I don't know, I'm going to buy something by post, for example. So I'm going to put my name and my personal data. I'm going to buy a book by post, for example. And then this company which sells book is going to, for example, send advertisement to me that I don't want, that I don't need. So that was the main problem somehow. But today the main problem is another one. We all use social networks, for example. I've been having a Facebook profile since 2007, and now I'm every day very concerned, for example, for what the others can see in my profile. If somebody is writing me something, or I don't know, I hardly put my own personal information. So this is one of the most important points. And then let's talk about, I don't know, online shopping. We have eBay. I've been buying on eBay since, I guess, 2005 or 2006. But now I'm actually doing it very rarely because I don't really trust the payment systems and the facture systems. So although I have a credit card that I use in a shop, I hardly use it over the internet because I know that I'm going to probably be a victim of fraud, identity theft, and so on. So that's why the commission now is going to take, let's say, some action and adopt measures, firstly, to grant citizens trust in the technologies. Mm-hmm. So then really the uptake of the technologies can become higher and higher, and this will have economic and, of course, societal benefits for everybody.
But you're not advocating that no one buy their plane ticket online or buy a book from Amazon or from some other place.
No, of course, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that the trust of the citizens is unfortunately very low because we had to look at the reality of the situation when we decided to write somehow the digital agenda. Of course, I talk about my commissioner somehow, but also we as services. And we saw that, for example, only 12% of European citizens really fully trust technologies and would really give their own personal data online. So that's where we need to start from. And for example, our privacy could be, I don't know, broken, as also in the case of a huge cyber attack. For example, in Estonia in 2007, it was huge. And Estonia was one of the, let's say, first class countries in Europe for the use and uptake of technologies, even not only, I don't know, home banking or online newspapers, but also, for example, public services were all carried out online. And it was a huge attack to Estonia. And this, of course, left all the citizens without anything all out of a sudden. So we shouldn't take it for granted. That's what we say. So we start from the worst case scenario and we build on that.
And a warm thanks there to Alessandra Falcinelli with the European Commission in Brussels Office for Cybersecurity. Earlier this year, the EU Commission and Parliament themselves fell victim to cyber attacks. September 11th, 2011 marks the 10th anniversary of the terror attacks on the United States. More than 3,000 people died after planes hijacked by Islamic terrorists slammed into the Twin Towers in New York, the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and a field in Pennsylvania. It was an event that was to change the course of world history. The Pope at the time was John Paul II, who vigorously rejected claims that the fear and animosity generated by the attacks should lead to a clash of civilizations. Few will forget his impassioned plea, repeated so many times, that the name of God never be used to justify violence. In response to the 9/11 attacks, on January 24, 2002, Pope John Paul organized a World Day of Prayer for Peace in Assisi here in Italy. The event followed the initial World Day of Prayer in the same Italian hill town in 1986, and another while the Balkan War raged in 1993. Some 200 Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, and other leaders of the world's different faiths came together and denounced the use of violence in God's name and rejected the making of religion a cause for conflict in the 21st century.
The Catholic lay community, Saint Egidio, has helped in the organization of these World Days of Prayer for Peace and similar initiatives around the globe. The community is planning a meeting of religious and lay people from around the world who will gather in Munich, Germany, on this year's anniversary of the 9/11 attacks to pray again for world peace. St. Egidio's International Department Chief Mario Giro told my colleague Luca Attanasio more about the initiative.
We think that is a turning point. We want to enter a new era after 10 years of clashes of war, of clash of civilization, so-called. We want to enter in an era of dialogue. St. Egidio has never gave up about dialogue. Dialogue is like life. We need to coexist, particularly in the areas of Middle East in which there are big or also little Christian minorities. And this gathering will be a new edition what we hope will be a new era of gathering of religions. In Munich, in Germany, also that is important. As you know, we organize every year this event in the spirit of Assisi, after 86 in Assisi, this great intuition of John Paul II that we want to continue. And this year we have been invited by the Archbishop of Munich in Germany, and Chancellor Angela Merkel will join the meeting.
St. Egidio volunteers have been instrumental in getting enemies to sit at the negotiating table to work for peace in Ivory Coast, the Republic of Guinea, and Mozambique. They provide counseling and care for AIDS victims and their families, advocate for a global end to the death penalty and the liberation of prisoners of conscience and hostages of violence. While St. Egidio has always believed in the healing power and the success of dialogue, even when dialogue seems impossible. So has there ever been a moment when they thought dialogue wouldn't succeed?
Never, in the sense that dialogue is difficult. Saying that dialogue is like life is difficult. Dialogue is also difficult. There is no such a thing like an embrassons nous, simplistic, and everything go in place. No, dialogue is difficult, but we need dialogue because our destiny is a common word, and in this common word we need to live together. The problem is that, for example, for the Muslims, it's very important to understand that the presence of Christian minorities is not only a question of Christianity, it's also a guarantee of pluralism and democracy for the Muslim world.
Since its creation more than 40 years ago, St. Egidio has promoted a series of interfaith sessions to stimulate the dialogue between Christian, Muslim, and Jewish leaders. One of the reasons for its success is that they have gathered enlightened, moderate Islamic scholars and Muslim representatives to participate in the dialogue. At the same time, their doors are open to more hardline Muslims.
There is a big reflection, a deep reflection into the Islamic world. Since 20 years, there is also a fight of legitimacy into the Islamic world. We have to help all those that understand that we have to live together in this earth. Not only the moderate, but also the real representatives, also meaning, I want to say, also the hardliners, but that want to understand the others. It's important to speak with the real representative of the Islamic world, that is, as you know, a very complex and articulated word.
Thanks there to Mario Giro, head of St. Egidio's International Department. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.